Today's expert interview is with a gentleman with a list of accolades longer than a Game of Thrones book, Jim Cathcart. He's the original motivation master, professional public speaker, best-selling author, rock and roll guitarist. He is a man on a mission. In the public speaking arena, this man is the authority on motivation. Before Les Brown, Zig Ziglar, and Tony Robbins, he is one of the original masters. We discussed what it was like to become one of the largest and most sought-after speakers in the country, and how he formulated relationship intelligence, and what motorcycle he wants to buy next. In this engaging interview, you'll not only learn tons, but enjoy it every step of the way. So, sit back and get ready to be motivated.
Or I can just...
Hello, everyone. Today, I am extremely excited to welcome Mr. Jim Cathcart to the show. Jim has authored 18 books, including Relationship Selling and The Acorn Principle. He's given more than 3,000 keynote speeches and has one of the most viewed TED Talks of all time with over 1 million views. He is a member of the Sales and Marketing Hall of Fame, the Professional Speakers Hall of Fame, the Golden Gavel Award recipient, former president of the National Speakers Association, the Legends of Speaking Professions Award, top 5 sales and customer speakers, top 50 sales influencers, top 50 influencers in the world. This man's list of accomplishments goes on and on. And he still has time to play rock and roll guitar in clubs and tour the world on a motorcycle. My favorite quote that I found describing Jim is that he is what Fonzie would be if he had gone to business school.
Thank you.
I'm so excited to have you on the show today. How are you?
I'm wonderful, and I'm thrilled to be with you, Brandon. Thanks.
Absolutely. Now, in your own words, if you don't mind, could you share with everyone a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, what I do for a living is I'm a professional speaker. And the reason I exist, I think, is to help people succeed. I went through a very extensive process a couple of times, to determine what is my life purpose? You know, why do I exist? What lights my fire and makes me feel fully alive and gives me a sense of meaning and purpose in what I'm doing? And it boiled down to the same philosophy as encapsulated in the biblical passage, John 10:10. It was quoting Jesus, and he said, "I've come that they would have life and have it more abundantly." Well, I think that same concept, not in a non-religious sense, is what appeals to me. I want to, and I am happiest when I'm helping other people live more fully, more abundantly, more successfully. And it's interesting, my family goes, I just did my DNA, you know, to swab the inside of your cheek and send it in. And it came back 93% British Isles, which would figure because Cathcart's a place in Scotland. And the family motto, going back to the whatever hundreds, you know, long, 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 long ago, is "I hope to speed." Now you think, what? That's odd. But if you look up the archaic meaning of speed, it had nothing to do with riding a horse rapidly. It meant, "I expect to succeed." Wow. What a family motto for a guy that ended up as a motivational speaker.
Yeah, that's a bit of kismet if I've ever heard it before.
Yeah.
I love it. Now, I know that you've had quite the journey to get from where you were to where you are now, and in watching your TED Talk and doing some research, I know that a lot of that comes down to one pivotal moment when you met a certain someone. And if you could tell a little bit about that story and share how that one moment just changed the trajectory forever.
Okay. You know, a lot of people say, Brandon, I went to your speech and you changed my life. And the fact is, no, they didn't. No, you didn't. They changed their life based on something you said or shared or some idea they got from it. Well, Earl Nightingale was the catalyst for me. He was a guy who was on 900 radio stations back in the 1970s. And so he was all over the world with this deep fatherly voice and this wonderful, wise old man way of delivering. And he was doing what you do. You know, he had a show. He had a podcast, basically. Today it'd be called that. but it was 5 minutes long, and I was a overweight, out of shape, two-pack-a-day smoking, no college degree, no money in the bank, no connections in the community, nice loser. I was a guy, not really a loser, but I wasn't going anywhere. And my parents had raised me to be a nice guy, but they never really inspired me to set big goals and go for, you know, making a difference in the world. So I didn't think I'd matter much. And I was newly married and working as a government clerk for the Housing Authority in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I was sitting there at my desk just bored. And I had read the books on urban renewal, and that didn't appeal to me, and I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And I hear the radio in the next room, and here's this deep voice, and Earl Nightingale says, if you'll spend 1 hour extra every day studying your chosen field, you'll be a national expert in that field in 5 years or less. Well, that stopped everything for me. I said, wait a minute. Hour a day, I'm a government clerk. I got 8 hours a day. I can do this by next week, you know. I'm thinking, hour a day extra? Yeah, I could do an hour a day extra. What do I want to study? Well, it wasn't urban renewal. What was it? I don't know. So I, you know, spent a few weeks thinking about that. And then finally it hit me. I want to do what he's doing. But I had no idea what he was doing. I just knew it felt right for me. And so I decided to take him up on his challenge, an hour a day extra. And I figured I'm starting from way behind, so I should do an hour and a half, 2 hours, whenever I can. And so I started studying the field of personal development, what would be called technically applied behavioral science. And that meant studying psychology, interpersonal communication, leadership, time management, strategic thinking, you know, all the quote soft skills that people need in order to have a good, abundant life. And in school, I'd only been taught basically hard skills, you know, that learn how to put this in this place and do that and turn it this way. And so I started, well, actually, I became fanatical. Now, if you look up the word fanatical, I mean it just like it says it in the dictionary, literally fanatical about studying personal development. That's all I wanted to think about, be around, or even consider for 5 consecutive years. Now, I was working as a government clerk. I had nothing else going on in my life except my wife and my brand new baby son. And so I started listening to recordings, first on records and then on cassette tapes, and listened to the recordings of Earl Nightingale every day. And I was reading all the classic books, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Dale Carnegie, The Power of Positive Thinking, Norman Vincent Peale, you know, and on and on. Well, I became very different in a short period of time because the friends that had been hanging out with me all of a sudden are saying, what's up with Cathcart? You know, I mean, this dude is different. And some of them didn't like that, and so they drifted away. And others would say, tell me more. And so we'd become more intensely connected. And new people connected with me, and my world started expanding. And by the end of the year, I was leading training programs that other people had designed, following their script, of course, because I didn't know anything. But I knew that, you know, if I taught these things, I would learn more about them. And so I started leading group discussions. I joined the Junior Chamber of Commerce called the JCs, which was real big at the time, 350,000 members. And I ended up going to 400 JCs meetings in 2 years.
Wow.
This is all free after work. This is Civic Club, you know, like Kiwanis or Rotary or Lions.
Mm-hmm.
But it was for younger people like me. And they had a program called Leadership in Action, which was a success course, basically. Learn to set goals, learn to communicate more effectively, learn to organize projects. And I became so enraptured with that that I ended up leading hundreds of discussions on weekends and at nights with other people, teaching them the things I'd learned from the manual earlier that same day. And by the end of the first year, I was getting pretty good at it. And by the end of the second year, I not only knew what I was talking about, I had come up with some original ideas of my own, and I had a lot of experience behind me. 400 meetings, are you kidding? Yeah. And I was hired by the USJC's national headquarters to be in charge of leadership training for 356,000 people. Now, pause. I was a clerk at the housing authority for $525 a month when I heard this guy on the radio. 2 years later, I'm at the national headquarters of the JCs in charge of leadership training programs for the entire nation. Are you kidding me?
Wow.
Yeah. And then a few years after that, I went out on my own and became a full-time trainer and consultant and then a professional speaker and moved to California, formed a partnership with a college professor. And one day I was sitting in my office in California. Now, in 1972, I heard Earl Nightingale on the radio. In 1974, I started selling Earl Nightingale's recordings to businesses on the side, you know, besides my JC's activity and other things. And in 1984, I was in La Jolla, California. My phone rang. I picked it up. It was the voice of Earl Nightingale live. Scared the daylights out of me. He said, "May I speak to Jim Cathcart?" And I said, which means, "This is he. How may I help you?" And I was terrified. That's my hero. That my mentor is in the phone right here talking to me, said my name. And I said, "This is he." And he said, "I just read an article of yours in a magazine, and I think it would make a good recorded program." And I said, "Well, sir, that is a recorded program. And my partner, Dr. Tony Alessandra, and I published it." He said, "Well, send it to me because I publish programs like that." I said, "Oh, believe me, I know." Well, long story short, in 1974, I was selling Earl Nightingale's recordings. In 1984, he was selling mine. He published that audio album called Relationship Strategies for Dealing with the Differences in People. And in 1984 and 85, they sold $3.5 million worth of that audio program.
That's exceptional.
The first audio program ever published on the subject of personality types.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, think how many there are today. Everybody and their brother.
Absolutely. That is incredible.
Yeah.
When you talk about personality types, just to go in a little bit deeper, do you base that on Myers-Briggs or the Big Five or your own take? Or how did you really come up with that?
Okay. Myers-Briggs is one version of many, 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 many versions out there. Myers-Briggs became popular because they were at the right place at the right time. But theirs is based on the work of Carl Jung. So Tony and I decided we were frustrated by the social styles model that we had each been taught by Dr. David Merrill and Wilson Learning Corporation. And we didn't like the Myers-Briggs model. It was too hard to remember and explain. And we looked at all the other models, and we decided we'll go back to the original research. Now, this goes back all the way to Hippocrates.
Mm-hmm.
Hippocrates talked about the four temperaments, sanguine, choleric, phlegmatic, and melancholy.
Melancholy.
Yeah, and so we went back to that and studied the temperaments, and came to about the same conclusion, but with a different understanding of things from some of the recent publishers. And then we went to the work of Carl Jung, which was obtuse, and had to read through all that because that was very clinical and And we came up with relationship strategies model, which Dr. Tony Alessandro still today publishes that. He uses the platinum rule, treat other people the way they want to be treated, as his overarching topic. And he owns a company that produces assessments for all the major companies out there that have their own versions. But the basic idea is there are four personality patterns that are present in all people, but there's so many more. You know, that's just personality. That's just behavior. There's also intellectual differences. There's also differences in intellectual bandwidth, the amount of processing power people have. There's differences in the value priorities that motivate what you do. There are differences in your energy patterns, which are called personal velocity, high, moderate, and low. There are differences in the way your background imprint has influenced who you became, positive, neutral, or negative. Two kids grow up in the same family, same treatment. One considers it positive, the other considered it abuse, you know, and one becomes successful and the other one's a drug addict. Good Lord, how do you explain all this? So I've spent years with many, many advanced researchers studying all this, and there is so much to know, we'll never know it all.
I think that's one of the things for us as we've gone down this rabbit hole of personality types and human development that makes it so fascinating.
Yeah.
Because when you take all this and you try to piece it together, and for someone who has even just that much knowledge is – more than the average bear, and taking that much and using that and applying it in your everyday life, you'll see nearly instantaneous results.
Yeah. Well, Tony Alessandro and I decided after a while we had done all the things we both wanted to do. And so we went back to separate businesses. We're still best friends. And I invested in a psychological research firm in Arizona and did the work that ultimately became the ACORN principle. So the ACORN principle is a self-guided tour of what makes you who you are. And it walks you through all those things I was just talking about, intellect, background imprint, velocity, values, personality type, and everything.
Now, tell me how that process went from taking all of this information, all that research, and funneling it into one book. How does that process work?
The first thing you do in a case like that is you get all the information assembled and make sure it's valid, you know, that it came from a reliable source and is proven, not just theoretical. And then you start thinking, all right, what door do you go in first? You know, where's the entry point for all this? And for most people, it'd be personality types, because that's something everybody sees. You could explain it to a 10-year-old, they'd get it, you know, that requires no processing power at all to understand personality types. And it's universal. It goes across all cultures and all ages and all genders and all everything, right? So it's just based on two things. It's based on how assertive you are, whether you're passive or active, and how open you are, whether you're very expressive or more reserved. And if you measure those two, you come up with a quadrant, you know, four quadrants, and every person behaves in all four quadrants in their life. But one or two of those is dominant all the time. And you say, oh, well, if you know Brandon, you know he's a this, right? And if you know Jim, he's a that. And that's pretty much your best bet, right? Like you recently interviewed Patricia Fripp, my good dear friend and colleague and former president of the National Speakers Association. Patricia Fripp is an explosion.
She's a firecracker.
Yeah, with an English accent. You know, I mean, she is just an explosion. And if you were to measure velocity, personal intensity, hers would be on if a metronome measures velocity and this is normal people, she'd be like this.
That's about right.
Yourself with it. And that's beautiful. But, you know, everybody's got their own patterns. And if you know their pattern, you can predict how they would respond to things. So you can think about how you could approach them and be more successful in sales or leadership or whatever it happens to be. And you get someone like Fripp, high energy, very creative, intensely disciplined, and positive view toward the world. If you put her into a corporation and gave her a cubicle to work in, she would wither away and die. She needs an open field of vision and the freedom to move and do what she's capable of doing. Absolutely. And we're all like that on some level. You know, we have things about us that make certain roles ideal and other roles absolutely not recommended.
That's
I'm not good in a factory, by the way.
It's all about taking that, and you sort of become a personality chameleon in how you can adapt, how you react, how you interact with everyone. And I think that really folds into what you've coined as relationship intelligence. Is that correct?
Yeah. Relationship intelligence is being more intelligent about relationships. And most people, when they hear that, they think, oh, that's just people skills. No. That's like comparing skin to a human body. that's not the whole picture. Relationship intelligence says your life is a series of interactions with other people. If you're intelligent about them, they will go well most of the time. If you're not, they will go according to whatever forces in the world direct them from somewhere else, and it won't necessarily be in your favor. Everyone can be more intelligent about who they connect with, how they connect with them, whether they connect with them. You know, scary guy with a big gun in a bad mood, I think I'll go over here, right? So you go somewhere else. So that's relationship intelligence on the fundamental level. You know, it's fight or flight, the safety and preservation kind of thing. But if I start thinking, okay, I want a career in, let's say, broadcasting, who would I need to know? Well, I want to know the president of the American Broadcasting Corporation. I want to know the Federal Communications Commission. Yeah, okay, nice, but you're at the entry level. Who do you need to know?
Your gatekeepers.
Yeah, I need to know anybody that's already in that field that seems to have their act together. So I go to Brandon and I say, Brandon, I'm really excited about this field of broadcasting and you seem to know some people. Who would you suggest I learn from? So I'm becoming more intelligent and intentional about who I connect with and who I follow. And then maybe I follow your advice and I find that's not leading me down the path I wanted, that I wasn't even really clear enough on it yet to ask good questions. So I asked the wrong question. And so at that newly enlightened level, I start asking better questions and better and better. And over time, I develop the mindset and then the actions and then the habits and then the reputation and then the relationships. And then my future becomes mine because I'm now eligible for it. Where when I started, I had no eligibility.
You've got to roll the snowball up the hill to get started.
That's right.
A certain amount of time, and then it'll pay you back in dividends once it gets going.
Good.
Now, what do you have to say to someone who, you know, they're rolling that snowball up the hill, and that can be a grind. And that,
sure.
And that is.
Yeah.
And knowing when to either stop pushing maybe a certain snowball and move to another one, or to push through knowing that you're only this far away from where you really want to be.
It's hard to answer that in the abstract. Mm-hmm. You know, if I had a specific example, I could probably relate to it more. But the main thing is, you know, on some deep level, what's right and what's not. You know, if you'll just learn to listen to your own reactions, not just physical reactions or emotional reactions, but to spend time every day, if you can, reflecting what happened. What do I notice about it? What could I learn from it? Are there different ways of approaching that? It's like this morning, I woke up and I just laid there in bed with my eyes closed for, I don't know, 20 minutes. And I was just reflecting on some of the major things in my life and thinking, is there a different way to look at that? And that's a habit pattern, a thought pattern that I've cultivated over 40 plus years of being intentional. And it's really served me well. And I think we all need to be more mindful, more reflective about the things in our life. And we'll notice when it just doesn't feel right. You know, people say, I've got a friend who's just so good with people. I mean, he or she knows if somebody's a crook or not, even when everybody else trusts them. And the only thing they've got going that the others don't have going is they're paying attention. They're noticing those little subtle things. They're saying, something's not right here. You know, I know if I act quickly and I'm one of the first 100 callers, but wait, there's more. I get two. And for only $19.95. And I really need this. Well, wait a minute. No, I don't need this. No, this is like sugar. It may be fun, but it's not good for me. Never mind. You don't order it.
To take the aspect of being so reactionary immediately and have that second to pause, look at it from different points of view, and then make a conscious decision about how you want to move forward. It's that simple, but it has such a ripple effect through the rest of your life and the successes that you have.
Indeed. Indeed.
Now, one of the things we've talked about in terms of success, and you've talked about in the Acorn Principle, is how thinking and acting out of the person that you want to be can help attract that future and help you get there. So is that just, there's more to it than simply thinking positive and thinking who you want to be.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Thinking positive is kind of, well, it's a symptom, you know, it's superficial. It's fine. It's the best way to think because, I mean, if you look at it, optimism or pessimism, people say, no, there's a third way. There's realism, which is just pessimists that don't admit it. But there's only two ways of looking at something. It'll work or it couldn't work, right? Or somewhere in between, but it's either more toward one side or the other side. There's not a middle side. There's just, it'll work or it won't work.
Yep. Right?
Pessimist, in advance of information, looks at the surface and says, it won't work. You might as well give up. Forget it. It's no use. It'll only hurt. Right?
Yeah.
It'll be painful. The optimist says, boy, that looks challenging, but there's bound to be a way. Let's find it. Okay, so the optimist keeps going longer than the pessimist. And the optimist, well, you say, yeah, but you could be pushing something up a hill that you don't want to be on top of. Yeah, you could. But the optimist is looking at opportunities and looking for possibilities.
They're problem solvers.
Mindset makes you conscious of things pessimists and, quote, realists don't see. Because the realist is just a person looking at current reality and assuming it's permanent. Well, that's never been the case. Nothing's permanent. So look at everything and say, all right, maybe this way isn't working, but there's bound to be a way. And if there's not, I'll give that up and I'll try something else. But first, I want to try and see if there is a way, right? Like my son said to me one time, he said, Dad, you know, I can't open this door. It's stuck. I said, then give up. He said, but I need to get in my room. I said, yeah, I know, but if you can't open the door, you can't open the door. Too bad. Life's over, right? Give up. He said, well, Dad, the door's stuck. I said, oh, well, that's different. If the door's stuck, we'll just get it unstuck and you can open the door. He didn't understand. He was too young. And so year after year, as he was growing up, I kept reinforcing that understanding that if you don't see a way, it doesn't mean you can't see a way. Like, I can't remember. Sure you can. But don't tell your mind not to. I can't remember tells your mind, take the day off, we're done. You know, I don't remember yet. What a powerful word that is, yet. I don't remember yet. Or I can't remember right now. You know, don't remember, but it'll come to me. And your subconscious keeps working on it. And bing, there's the idea a few minutes later. You know, can't open the door? Yeah, you can. Let's move the door a little bit. Ah, I can open the door. Congratulations, son. High five.
Yeah, looking at the world as a set of problems that you need to figure out how to solve them.
Yeah. Yeah. Life is a series of problem-solving events, and problem-solving is a learnable skill.
Now, speaking of skills, what would you say are the top three skills necessary for success today?
Self-awareness, because if you don't know, if you don't have the ability to kind of step back and notice what you're doing and how you're reacting and whether it's the best way or not, then you'll never improve yourself. You'll only be improved by someone else forcing it from the outside, if ever. So self-awareness. Second would be, commitment to succeed. So, you know, when people ask me, what's the key ingredient for success? Commitment to succeed. Because if you're not committed to succeed, you will simply attempt to succeed. And if you attempt and it doesn't work, I can't succeed. Right? Your mind shuts down, your will, and all that. I've looked at the people that have best-selling books, you know, continuing bestsellers, not just momentary ones. Because mm-hmm. You can buy a two-week period of being a bestseller, but you cannot buy a year, 2 years, 3 years of it, or 10 years of it. I've looked at people whose businesses have thrived. I've looked at people, well, I'd take J.K. Rowling, all right, Harry Potter.
Yep.
How long was that process? How many times did she have to persevere and you know, struggle through and just barely have enough money to eat and still stay the course before she finally got the publisher she needed and became a multi-gazillionaire with Harry Potter? Well, you know, the same thing's been true for most of the major successes throughout all of history. Everyone encounters difficulty in the early phases and sometimes in the later phases. Major difficulty, bankruptcies, things like that. Walt Disney is said to have gone bankrupt twice. I mean, Disneyland would not have happened had he said, you know, I've tried this before. Man, I think I'll just take that job working for Uncle Fred. You know?
That's it.
So it's that one's commitment to succeed, which means perseverance and things like that will be symptomatic of that commitment.
Mm-hmm.
So number one is self-awareness. Number two is perseverance. Number three is gratitude. If you cultivate a grateful mindset, grateful for what? Grateful for air. Grateful for the privilege of being alive. Grateful for being born in the free world instead of a enslaved world. Grateful for being in a family where you were loved or accepted or at least not beaten with a stick every day. Grateful for the ability to see and hear and smell and read, and grateful for televisions and computers. And good Lord, there's so much to be grateful for. If you cultivate a grateful mindset, you become more humble and humility is a very endearing trait. And other people want to be around you. You know, I teach in relationship intelligence. I teach people it's not what you know that counts, and it's not who you know that counts. And it's not who knows you that counts, and it's not who they know that counts. Here's what counts. Who's glad they know you? And if you want to make people glad they know you, look for ways to appreciate and acknowledge what they have done or who they are or something like that. A grateful spirit draws to it other people.
That is some exceptional words of wisdom right there. I love it. Now, figure out where to go from there. So we really have two main audiences. We've got recent college grads that are trying to figure out what to do as they enter the world of the things they've never learned. And then professionals that are a bit into their career that are learning, well, I still haven't learned these things that I needed to take my career to the next level. So in terms of communication skills, those soft skills we've spoken about so much, where does someone start if they want to improve those interpersonal relationships?
Well, let me first address their situation and their mindset.
Mm-hmm.
When I graduated, I didn't graduate college. When I left college, I had 3 years total. I left after two, and then I came back and picked up some more courses, but I never did get my degree. And by the way, no degree, certainly not a PhD, not a master's, but not even a bachelor's. I currently serve as entrepreneur in residence for the School of Management for California Lutheran University. For 6 years, I served as an advisor to the School of Business at Pepperdine University. I've been an advisor to the dean at the Fisher School of Professional Selling at the University of Akron, Ohio. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you don't have to have a college degree to succeed, but it's easier if you do. And I wish I had my PhD. It would have opened even more doors for me. So let's say you're getting close to graduation in college. You're not sure what you want to do with your life. Neither are most everyone else you know, right? Neither is most everyone else you know. I've had so many people over the years tell me they didn't have a clue what they wanted to do with their life until they were in their 30s or even later. And I remember when I was in my 30s and I was teaching sales and motivational courses, I had a guy who was 60-something years old. He came to me and he said, could I get like an hour of your time? Could I buy your lunch or something? And I said, well, sure. Yeah, you work here and I'm, you know, this is my client. So, of course. So we sat down together over coffee And he said, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. I said, for heaven's sakes, you're 60 years old. I'm 30 years old. You should be advising me. What do you mean you don't know what you're supposed to do? He said, well, what do you think? What am I supposed to do with my life? I said, well, first off, supposed to implies there's a rule book, that somebody has written an outline of the way things are going to work. So what's your rule book? Is it the Bible? You know, where's your rule book? He said, I don't know. And I said, okay, so obviously you're not in charge of your life. He said, well, yeah. I said, no. If you are looking to some other source for the supposed to, then you're not in charge of your life by default. You just choose not to be because of your mindset. He said, well, I hadn't thought of that. I said, it might be useful. He said, yeah, it might. And I said, what do you care about? He said, why? I said, well, let's helicopter up and approach this differently. Let's assume for a moment you're the creator of heaven and earth. You're God, okay? And you've created humans, and you've given humans skills and abilities, and you've made them capable of doing great things and horrible things for that matter, okay? How are you going to get them to do the things you want them to do? He said, I don't know. I said, how about making it pleasing? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, if you want a kid to do something, you cause the thing to be pleasing in some way. You make it fun, you make it interesting, you make it delicious, you make it comfortable. He said, yeah. I said, okay, so if you were the creator, wouldn't you design people so that what they care about, what they feel truly connected with, what they find to be totally enjoyable and fulfilling, that's the thing you designed them to do in the first place? He said, yeah, that would make sense, wouldn't it? I said, so let's assume that's true. What do you love? I don't know. I said, that's because you're thinking about your job and not about your love. Tell me the times in your life you felt most alive. Well, and all of a sudden the stories came. And then I said, okay, now notice the pattern in these stories. When you notice the patterns of what made you feel fully alive and feel like you were worthwhile and the world mattered and God's in his heaven and all's right with the earth, that's the moment when you are telling yourself, whether you're listening or not, this is what I was meant to be. Like me, when I'm helping other people succeed, man, I'm firing on all cylinders. You know, I love it. I don't have to have the spotlight on me. Long as I know they're getting value from it, cool. Let's do it. So there you go.
That's it. It's that simple. But you've got to listen to yourself, and you've got to actually go after and chase those dreams, even when they're not easy to chase.
Yeah.
I love it. Now, for you, in addition to helping all these people, you do take center stage occasionally and get up there for your keynote speeches.
Yeah, I love doing it.
And could you tell us a few tips? So maybe someone's got a presentation or they've got a speech upcoming. One of the most critical things is structuring your information in a way that makes your audience listen, but those first few moments are pivotal. So how can you really come up and snap someone's attention right from the get-go and have all eyes on you?
Mindset. Absolutely, 100% mindset. Not your behavior, your thinking. Because your behavior will reflect whatever thinking you bring to the platform. You can have a wonderful, caring, loving, generous behavior pattern that you do every time you get on stage. You know, hey, everybody, gosh, it's so good to see you here. I love da-da-da-da-da and this and that and the other. If your mindset is not embracing that feeling, they will know. They will feel it. They'll say, okay, that guy said the right words, but there's some of the employees stayed home in his company today. Something inside that machine is missing. I don't know. You know, I hear the music, but those aren't the lyrics, right? So number one is mindset. What does that mean? It means that when you're sitting there before your speech and someone's saying, here comes Jim, what are you going to think about? Well, I'm going to think about my first words. No. Think about this audience. Think about the people. Think about this. People say, what's the most important thing in a speech? The message? No. The messenger? You? No. The audience? No. The setting? No. What's left? The most important thing in a speech is what the audience can do with the message you're bringing. What the audience can do with the message you're bringing. It doesn't matter if they learn the message. It matters whether it benefits them to learn the message. Okay? So be thinking about them and about how you can be of service to them and cultivate admiration and respect for them. Once I was giving a speech and I had a staff member, a new guy, who had come aboard with my company, and he had gone to the speech with me, and all the way to the engagement, we were in a limo, a sedan, and all the way to the engagement, I was telling him, here's the organization, here's what they do, here's what my assignment is, here's how I'm approaching it. And so we get to the meeting, and it's hundreds and hundreds of people in a big room with all kinds of audio visual and cameramen up on a perch back here and a big stage. And the people running the meeting are doing a very poor job of it. And when someone introduces the next presenter, they leave the stage and leave it empty while the other person's coming up instead of waiting for them to come up there and, you know, and then departing the stage. And it's being done in a very amateurish way, even though they spent a fortune staging it. And I'm the keynote speaker. And so my new staff member is saying to me, look at this. Can you believe how unprofessional? I said, hang on. I know what you're saying might be accurate, but you need to stop because I cannot afford to think anything but helpful, positive thoughts about this audience. And that will cultivate disdain instead of respect in me. And he said, got it. And he shut up, and I focused on that audience and thought about them. And see, when I get on the stage, I've got a LRAMA in my mind, and sometimes I write it down on my notes. LRAMA, LaRama, like, respect, and admire my audience. Like, respect, and admire my audience. So I look for things to like about them. I look for things that I can respect about their company, their industry, their product, their whatever, their approach to things. And I look for something to admire, a quality that's present in them. Even if they're failing, you know, and having a horrible time, I can at least admire their willingness to find a solution or their eagerness to make it better. Or their humility and ability to apologize when they did something wrong. You know, whatever. Like, respect, and admire my audience. And in doing that, I know those opening moments will always be uplifting instead of awkward.
It's just when you speak like that, you can tell your passion for what you do, and you can see that. It's only to see you live would only be magnified on stage in that atmosphere to know that you're not just saying words, that that's really and truly the process. It's how it works. And just in you explaining how it works, I'm here leaning forward, ready to take in every word. So
love it. Well, that's the key, you know, it's sincerity. And I've had people say to me, and it's very odd that this has been said exactly the same way every time. And I mean that. Over 41 years as a full-time professional speaker, I've had multiple hundreds of occasions where people come up to me at the end of my speech and they say, you know what I liked or appreciated, they'll say it either way, the most about your presentation? No. Your sincerity. I don't know why it always comes out the exact same way, but people say, you know what I like the most? You know what I respected the most? You know what I admired the most? What? Your sincerity. So evidently, many of the presenters they had heard didn't appear to mean what they were saying, and they totally got it that I did.
And it makes,
I do.
And it makes such a difference in their lives. That's what follows through.
Absolutely. You know, it's like people talk about honoring the diversity among people, you know, like respecting the differences. And one of my recent blog posts was about going to a dance at the National Speakers Convention years ago. And I was observing the dance floor, and there were people out there, three people out there in wheelchairs, dancing with people who weren't in wheelchairs. And there was a little person, a woman who's like 3.5 feet tall, dancing with a guy who was probably 5'10". There was a person out there who had been horribly melted by a burn. And you know, most people would go, oh, like that on seeing the person. And in that atmosphere of acceptance, everybody was just being treated like somebody, you know, like the bar scene in Star Wars, right? Everybody's so bizarre that, you know, you might as well just get on with it, right? And it wasn't about judgment. It was just about the joy of living and all these people being connected like that. Well, if you see someone in a wheelchair and you squat down to talk with them on eye level, but it's just a technique you're using, they'll know. It's not going to do you a lot of good. It'll do you some good, but because it's courteous. Mm-hmm. But if you don't mean to connect with them, then it's still going to come across in some kind of a disconnected way. But if you genuinely want to communicate with them, you know, you might grab a chair and sit down beside them and take an interest in them and not talk about the obvious things, unless it was appropriate to talk about the obvious things. You know, like, I'm able to talk with someone who has a extreme condition, you know, maybe their arms aren't fully formed or they've got some kind of a facial deformity or they've got a, maybe they're blind or whatever. I'm able to talk with them in such a natural and comfortable way that I can inquire about their condition without it seeming judgmental.
Right. It's the actual interest in the other person.
Yeah, it's real.
That exudes. It's real. Now, through all your performances and all your keynote speeches, is there one that stands out as a favorite?
Wow. How long you got? Man, I've had some of the finest, the most amazing, and some of the most hideous and terrifying you can imagine. You know, I had a guy almost die in one of my speeches. I've had a room catch on fire. I've had to evacuate 700 people. I've had to deliver a speech standing on the street below a bunch of steps, concrete steps, because the building was shut down for a fire, and we were outside in the cold of winter, and we couldn't get back in the building or any of the other buildings for a few hours. And so I just assembled the people on the steps of a neighboring building and gave a speech a cappella. I came into a meeting one time in a monster truck in a rodeo arena. It was for Earth Moving Equipment Company, and it was in Louisville, Kentucky at the fairgrounds. And they said, okay, Larry's going to bring you in when we introduce you. And I said, okay, hi, Larry. He said, hey, come on over here. And we climbed up the tire, grabbed onto the foot and up into the cab to get into his monster truck. And he fired it up, and flames were racing out of the thing. And there were neon lights under the wheel wells and everything. And we go racing across this arena, in a darkened arena, and we're throwing a rooster tail of dirt. And he goes up on two wheels and turns and goes back and stops in front of the stage and says, okay, jump. And I had to jump down to the stage that looked like a postage stamp in my suit and wingtip shoes and then deliver a speech to the audience across the arena. Wow.
That's an entrance.
Yeah. I've come into the room on a motorcycle. It's been fabulous. I've had some of the finest experiences a person could ever have.
Oh, that's incredible. Now, you've also shared the stage with, spoke at different events, and mentored some incredibly successful people throughout your time.
Oh, yeah.
And how have you been able to build and sustain and nurture such an immense and powerful network?
Self-awareness, commitment to succeed, gratitude, and humility. Seriously, when I went to the first National Speakers Convention in 1978, my first convention, I went to Louisville, Kentucky, coincidentally, same city a while ago. And 1978, National Speakers Association, all my heroes were there. There was Dr. Kenneth McFarlane and Earl Nightingale and, you know, people like that. Earl himself was not there, but Nick Carter was there to accept the Speaker Hall of Fame Award on behalf of Earl Nightingale. And Nick was the vice president of Earl's organization. And all these big names that I knew, and they had a new speaker there who was getting really popular at the time, Zig Ziglar. Zig went to the top of the food chain, you know, before he passed away a few years ago. And I went up to all these people and I just listened and I volunteered to help. And so I stuffed name badges into little holders, and I arranged chairs and put signs up for meeting rooms and did things like that. And they had a big Speaker Hall of Fame initial award program that was extra, $40 extra, and I couldn't afford that. So I went across the street and got a hot dog from a vendor and came back and stood in the hallway and listened through the door. And that was the initial, that was the first class of inductees into the Speaker Hall of Fame by the National Speakers Association.
Oh, wow.
I was a little rosy-cheeked kid in his 30s standing out in the hallway listening in.
And what year did you get inducted?
I was inducted in 1985. And then I was president of the National Speakers Association in 1988-89. And then I received their Lifetime Achievement Award, the Cavett Award, named for the founder of the association. And that's the award over there in the corner.
Oh, wow.
Our founder. And that was in 93. And then in the year 2001, I received, you see that award in the Lucite case there?
Yep.
Next to the microphone?
Yep.
That's the Golden Gavel Award from Toastmasters International. Previous recipients include Earl Nightingale, Walter Cronkite, Zig Ziglar, and after me, people like Anthony Robbins, it goes on and on. Patricia Fripp hasn't received that, but she's received a lifetime award from Toastmasters.
Exceptional. Wow.
Oh, I met and became friends with Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, Og Mandino, the author of The Greatest Salesman in the World. Ken Blanchard had lunch with Anthony Robbins, also did the firewalk with him. Zig was a good friend all the way through the last years of his life. I served on committees with him. So you name them. Les Brown came up to me one time, and he said, "You're Jim Cathcart, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I'm Les Brown, and I'm going to become a professional speaker. And I'm going to be a famous motivational speaker." And I said, "Well, good for you. Where are you going right now?" He said, "My first paid speaking engagement." I had already been president of the National Speakers Association. Les was getting started. Now Les is a big deal. I remember when Brian Tracy lived in Canada. He came to me after one of my speeches, and he said, "You live in La Jolla, California, San Diego." "Yeah." He said, "I'm thinking about moving to California. Could I come down and have lunch with you?" I said, "Yeah, I'll get my partner," because back then I was still partners with Tony. And so the two of us had lunch with him in La Jolla and told him what it would be like to be in America in business. And today he's an American citizen and one of the biggest names in the motivation field worldwide.
Wow. Now, following through here, I know you've listed quite a few of your inspirations, but is there someone who really stands out as the big inspiration to you?
two of them, Earl Nightingale and Og Mandino, kind of head and shoulders above the rest. Earl Nightingale, because his philosophy is the one that I embrace and listen to for so many hundreds and hundreds of hours on recorded, you know, on cassettes back then, to reprogram my own thinking to be much more open-minded, optimistic, and clear on what I believed and what I understood to be true about the world. And then Og Mandino, through all of his books, The Greatest Salesman in the World, The Greatest Miracle in the World, The Choice, The Christ Commission, you know, so many different books that he wrote. And Og became a good friend. Just an inspiring person. And I could go on, but those were major ones for me.
Oh, fantastic. Now, I know you've listed quite a few books as well, but do you have any favorite books or book recommendations for everyone out there?
Well, of course. The books by Jim Cathcart.
Absolutely.
The Acorn Principle. The Acorn Principle and on and on. Yep. My next one is going to be called, my latest one is called The Self-Motivation Handbook.
Okay.
36 ideas of how to get yourself to do what needs to be done when it needs to be done and you don't feel like doing it yet. Okay.
Yeah.
That's this one right here.
Okay.
And you can just go to theselfmotivationhandbook.com or cathcart.com mm-hmm. and find out all about that. But my next one's going to be called Public Speaking, What to Do When You're the Speaker. So many of the things we talked about today are part of what that book is all about.
Fantastic. And when might we be expecting that one?
Well, I'm not sure on the book itself, but I've already recorded many of the videos that will be used for the online course. Mm-hmm. And some of those are already posted up for free on my website, cathcart.com. So go there, look at the videos, and just scroll through all the free videos on there, and you'll get some good ideas.
Now, I was looking through all, you've got quite a few digital products, lots of videos and things. Is there somewhere that you recommend someone starts with all the stuff that you've created so far?
It really depends on where they're starting from. For example, if they're in sales, relationship selling is a great starting point. And it's broken into 9 ebooks as well as the main book. So you can get that digitally or you can get it in print or whatever. If you're in a point of transition like the college students or the mid-career people we were talking about, then start with the Acorn Principle. If you just want to figure out, how do I get more done now? Self-Motivation Handbook. I mean, 68 ways to motivate yourself, 336 ideas that you can read one minute at a time mm-hmm. to go through here and get a jump start in your life. And the book starts with a number of exercises to help you answer the question, what do I want? Because until you know what you want, everything else is premature.
Fantastic. Now, two last questions here to wrap everything up. This one's always one of my favorites. If you could have a conversation with anyone, past, present, future, fact or fiction, who would it be?
Wow, fact or fiction? Woo, that just expanded the envelope. Roy Rogers.
All right.
Rogers, the cowboy star of movies and TV shows back in the 50s and even before. Just an amazing guy. He lived here where I live, Thousand Oaks, California. He lived in Hidden Valley just over the hill from where my house is and had a big ranch there, and that's where they filmed many of his movies and TV shows. As a matter of fact, Tom Selleck lives over there. Paul Anka, the singer, lives over there. Britney Spears, Gary Sinise.
What a neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. It's a heck of a neighborhood. I lived, it was Sherwood Country Club, and I lived there for about 10 years, and we were able to sell at a profit when the market was down. So we said, we better get out while it was good. And we moved only about 3 miles away, but saved ourselves gazillions. And we're still able to go over there all the time.
Wonderful. Now, final question. Is there anything that you wish I had asked, or do you have any final words of wisdom?
Yes. I wish you had asked, what kind of motorcycle can someone give me if they want to just make my life? And the answer is a Triumph.
A Triumph.
Bonneville T120 2017 or newer model.
Okay. You want a new one? No classics for you.
No, not the old one, the new one, because it's got anti-lock brakes, it's got fuel injection, it's comfortable, everything's more reliable. And I've ridden one of those several hundred miles. I'm a life member of the American Motorcyclists Association. I've toured much of the world on a motorcycle, the Alps, the Rockies, Canada, and so forth, and certainly all of California, New England. And I've owned Harleys and Yamahas and Suzukis and Kawasakis and Hondas and, name it, BMWs. But at this point in my life, after owning three different Triumphs, I don't have a bike currently, and my next bike will probably be a Bonneville T120.
All right. Bonneville T120, it's 2017 or newer. It's out there into the internet now.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Jim, I appreciate so, so much. You have given such incredible wisdom. I've got three pages full of notes here, and once I go back and watch this again, I'm going to have even more.
Good.
But I know that our audience has enjoyed, and from the bottom of my heart, I appreciate the time you took to be here with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. And by the way, go to guitarmusiclive.com.
Okay.
And you'll be able to see some videos of some of our musical performances. I perform about once a month with my wife and some friends. And I've been doing that for about 8 years. And so we still work as professional musicians, doing gigs at events and bars and nightclubs and places like that, in addition to my speaking career. And it's great fun.
So what's your encore song? At the end of the night, you've had a great set and they're calling you back for one more. What is it going to be?
Well, I was born in the baby boom.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the baby boomers are now retiring or they're kind of disengaging. I wrote a song called Resume the Boom.
Resume the Boom.
Yeah. For too long now, I've been headed toward the exit. For way too long, I've forgotten to be me. For too long now, I've looked for strength in others when all along I had the strength in me. So resume the boom. It's time to call the roll again. Resume the boom. We'll rock and roll to the very end. Resume the boom. I still have a dream, sweetheart. Restart. Resume the boom.
I love it. I can't wait to listen to it.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Well, once again, Jim, I appreciate you so very much. And this was absolutely excellent.
You bet. My pleasure. Thanks.
And that's a wrap. What did you think? Let us know your favorite tip that you learned in the comment section below. If you know someone who could use a little bit of inspiration and some motivation, go ahead and send them this video. I'm sure that they will appreciate it. Below, I've included links to Jim's website, his books and programs. So if there's something that we talked about during the interview and you want to find out more about it, I've made it super easy for you and put all that information below. As always, click subscribe right down there in the corner so that you never miss a video, and turn on your notifications so that you get notified every time that we upload a brand new video. Remember, every Wednesday we've got expert interviews just like this so you can learn the very best tips from the pros themselves. Monday are life lessons from TV shows, and Friday we have our difficult behaviors and personality breakdown. So a little bit of something for everyone. And finally, last but not least, don't miss open enrollment on our brand new course, Millennial Magnetism, which will help you to unleash your inner awesome, be more charismatic, and talk to anyone in only 10 minutes a day. Click the description box for all the details on that as well. And until next time, ciao for now.